This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Salman Rushdie has spent 3 years and 3 months in hiding. The death sentence, or fatwa, issued against him by the Ayatollah Khomeini, remains in effect. The million-dollar bounty on his head has been doubled to $2 million. But in spite of all that, he sometimes manages to get out, and that's important both for his own sanity and to keep his case before the public eye. At the end of March, he came to the United States for a brief visit. He hopes America and other Western governments will pressure Iran to revoke the fatwa. And even though he's in hiding, he's still writing and getting published. The paperback edition of Satanic Verses was recently brought out by a consortium of publishers. And now Granta has published a paperback edition of Rushdie's essays from 1981 to 91. It's called Imaginary Homelands. We arranged for Rushdie to call us so we could talk about his recent writing and find out how the efforts to end the fatwa were going.
Unfortunately, I mean, one would have hoped that the effect would have been greater by now of all these months of campaigning that's been going on both by me and on my behalf, because in the end, you see, one has to understand the real nature of this problem. The real nature of this problem isn't that there are thousands and thousands of people out there really anxious to do me harm. The problem is that there's a government out there which has been trying to finance and arrange an assassination, and the way it's going to end this problem is when that government can be persuaded to desist. So, I mean, that's the nature of the deadlock right now, which is that the Iranians are being told by the British and by European governments, so forth, that they have to sort out this problem before relations can be normalized, and they're not doing so. So that's the, you know, at the moment we seem to be in a state of more or less standoff.
I know when you were in the United States, you hoped to meet with American officials. And Marlon Fitzwater, the White House spokesperson, said there's no reason for us to have any special interest in Rushdie. I mean, he's an author. He doesn't write about government policies. And State Department spokesperson Margaret Tutwiler said that no one was meeting with you because at this time they felt that such a thing could be misinterpreted. Were you very disappointed that no one in the government would meet with you?
Oh, sure. I mean, I certainly was disappointed. I mean, I should say that I had made no attempt to set up such a meeting. I mean, I had been told that there was an interest amongst the senators in having some sort of meeting, and indeed that meeting did take place and was very helpful. I mean, a lot of senior senators met with me and expressed support and said that they would continue to press the case, and that's, of course, very valuable. I mean, naturally, it would have been very valuable if members of the administration had been willing to meet with me, and clearly it was very disappointing that they didn't. And I mean, I think Mr. Fitzwater's remarks about my being an author and a book tour were, I would have said, misplaced, because I mean, if that's what it's like being on a book tour, then I mean, it's not surprising that so many writers dislike doing them.
The ultimate put down of the book tour. You've said that people have to start seeing your position as a political, not just a religious issue.
Yeah. Well, I think that's true, because I think, you know, one of the things people in the West have, I think, in the last few years been obliged, partly by this issue, to become more aware of what's going on in the Islamic world and in those countries where fundamentalism is on the increase. One of the things I think is necessary for people to start seeing is that the incident of the Satanic Verses, or the case of the Satanic Verses, is not an isolated case. I mean, it's not that I'm somebody who did something so uniquely horrible that it required a uniquely horrible response. If you start looking at what's been happening to writers throughout the Islamic world, throughout Arab countries and in Iran, you see a mounting attempt to censor and attack and persecute writers in all those countries. Writers being sentenced to enormous jail sentences, writers having to go into exile, writers being jailed, persecuted, tortured, and in many cases even killed. And the interesting thing is that in every single one of those cases, the accusation made against those writers is that they have acted in a way that is insulting to Islam, that they have blasphemed, and so forth. I think one of the problems with the cloak that religion gives to dictators and to totalitarian regimes is that it uses a language which seems to obscure the political facts. Now, what's happening to me, what's happening to other writers throughout the Muslim world, is, in my view, nothing different than what happened to writers, for example, in Stalinist Russia. But somehow, when one is a dissident,
Mm-hmm. England resumed diplomatic relations with Iran last year. Do you wish that they hadn't resumed before?
Well, they resumed very low-level relations. I mean, they have the minimum relationship. That's to say, they've exchanged charge d'affaires with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, they would say that the benefit that accrued from that was the release of the British hostages in Lebanon and the release of the British businessman, Roger Cooper, who was in jail in Tehran at the time. Now, I mean, I'd go along with that even. I mean, probably that's fair enough. But for a time, I was very alarmed by the possibility that they might then go on to resume full relations with Iran before this issue was resolved. And I think, frankly, there was a point about 6 months ago when it looked likely that that might happen. Since then, it is true to say that the British government has strengthened its position and is now saying to Iran that it will not restore full relations, it will not exchange ambassadors and so forth, until this issue is resolved. So at least now that is clearly on the table.
Well, what effect did the release of the hostages have on you?
Well, for a start, it made it possible for me to speak freely for the first time throughout this period, because while there were Western hostages in Lebanon, I was constantly told both by the government, I mean, both by the Foreign Office and by the media, that the louder I yelled, the more I was prolonging their problems. So I was in this sort of terrible cleft stick where, in order to pursue my own case, I would be accused of damaging the interests of other people whose condition was, if anything, even worse than mine. Now, that isn't so. I mean, now, for the first time, I'm able to say what I want to say and what I have to say, what I think needs to be said, without being accused of damaging other people's safety or well-being. So it's unlocked my tongue, if you like, and it's also made it possible for me to contemplate other things which I'm pleased to say have happened, such as the publication of the paperback of the static verses, without being accused again of doing something which would prolong the hostage's agony.
Two of the translators of Satanic Verses were attacked, a Japanese and an Italian translator, and one was killed, one survived the attack.
That's right.
Was that a sign of an escalating attempt to find you, do you think?
Well, certainly. That happened at a time last year when I was also hearing from intelligence sources of there being contracts out against my life. So I think there was a time last year when things became very dangerous, and the attacks on the translators showed exactly how dangerous. I mean, again, one has to hope that that period is gradually receding, and that things will become safer. But, I mean, one can't do anything but go on repeating that this issue will not simply fade away and disappear. It will go away when it's fixed. And the way of fixing it is to have a serious political conversation between the Western government and the Iranian government. And, of course, if the United States government were to wish to lend its support to that, that would make a big difference. We're already in a situation where the British have a strong position, where many of the European governments have a strong position. And you know, it would be nice to feel that the government of the country, which, after all, has a First Amendment guaranteeing freedom of speech, would understand that this was an issue that affected them, too.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Salman Rushdie, and he, I should mention, has a collection of essays that's just come out in paperback called Imaginary Homelands. And, of course, as I'm sure you've heard, Satanic Verses is out in paperback as well. This is Fresh Air. Joining us on the telephone is Salman Rushdie. The last time we spoke was on, which was also the first time we spoke, making it sound like we've spoken so many times. The other time we spoke was on December 21st of 1990. And you had said in that interview that you had not become more religious while you were in hiding, and that you were still hoping that the paperback of Satanic Verses would soon be published.
Mm.
And then just a couple of days later, over the weekend, I'd read in the newspapers that you'd met with English Islamic leaders, and that you had said you embraced Islam and that you had canceled the publishing of the paperback. What happened in that intervening time?
Well, for a start, let's be correct. I never canceled the paperback. I said that I would suspend it.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Yeah.
But it's I've been through this a number of times, but I suppose what happened was I've characterized it many times as a mistake, and I think it was a fairly desperate attempt to break the deadlock. I was basically offered a kind of compromise by a number of Muslim leaders who said that they accepted the book was not insulting and so forth, and that in return for this they would make sure that there would be a big campaign inside the Muslim world explaining that. And I suppose it was a kind of desperate throw, trying to get some progress on this issue. But I shouldn't have done it, because it put me in a false position. I mean, it put me in a position of saying, of making statements which I couldn't really adhere to. Because, in fact, I don't have, in any formal sense, a religious belief. What I suppose, the way in which I justified it to myself, was to say that there was a developing secular trend inside Islamic thought, and it would be nice to be a part of that. And by telling myself that, after all, this was a book that came quite deeply out of Muslim culture, and there was no reason why I shouldn't make a statement of affiliation to that. But those were all, in a way, justifications. And there you are. It was a mistake. I mean, I think it was a mistake made for good reasons and under immense pressure, but it was still something I shouldn't have done.
Promises did they make that they broke?
Well, they said they were going to start an enormous campaign throughout the Muslim world, explaining that the book was not an insult. There were promises of sort of backstage political help from this or that Islamic country, which never materialized. There were a lot of things, but what actually happened was that within a day or two of having that meeting and shaking hands and being terribly cheery and friendly, they were beginning to abuse me in public again. So I basically felt as if I'd been had, and I think probably I had.
So has that made you more skeptical of making any kinds of deals with anybody else?
Well, I think it made me more skeptical, period. I think, you know, in a strange way, you know, The Satanic Verses is a novel that's, in fact, for whatever people say about it, actually is quite open-minded and even sympathetic about religious belief. But since then, I think one could say that religion has had such a catastrophic effect on my life that I'm probably less sympathetic towards it than I was when I wrote the novel.
In your new collection of essays, you write that the first article that you wrote at age 21 was actually banned by national censors. What was this article about?
It was a strange story. It's the sort of thing that happens. I'd just left university. I was 21 years old. My parents were in Pakistan. I'd gone back to be with them. And a little magazine in Karachi asked me to write an article about what it felt like to come back east from the west, and what were my impressions. So I wrote a typically undergraduate, really, essay about wandering around the streets of Karachi and being rather conventionally appalled by the poverty. I recall there being dying horses with flies on their eyeballs in this essay. But I don't recall there being anything directly political in it at all. And I was extremely surprised when I was told by the magazine that the press council, that's to say the board of censors, had turned it down completely. Actually, at that time, I had an uncle on the press council, so I said I'd go, in a rather kind of undemocratic way, I told the magazine I'd go and see my uncle and sort it out. So I did, but he was completely intransigent. He never told me why or what it was that was so terrible about what I'd done. He just said, "We feel it would be in your best interest for this not to be published."
Well, even an uncle was saying that.
Even my uncle, yes. Very strange place, a country under total censorship is a very strange place.
Well, how did that shape your attitude about censorship?
Well, I tell you, when you're a young writer just starting out, there's a thing that's very difficult that censorship does to you, which is that actually you don't know if you're good or bad. I mean, for example, there's something rather glamorous about being censored. So that, for example, in the case of the story we've just been discussing, it would have been very easy for me to conclude that I'd written something explosive and brilliant and far too advanced for these people to tolerate. Whereas actually, it was a piece of juvenilia. It wasn't something that that I would now look back on with any kind of pride. Now, it's very difficult in a situation where you can be glamorized by censorship on the one hand, and on the other hand, where you actually can't openly discuss your work, so you can't learn and progress. One of the reasons why I didn't stay in Pakistan, why I went back to live in England, was because I felt I had to be in a climate in which it was possible to know that when people liked your work, it was because it was good rather than because it was towing a party line. And when people disliked your work, it was because it was bad rather than because it was offending against some party line.
Right. I've been seeing some of your reviews, you know, in magazines and book reviews, and I guess I always wonder, like, how do you manage to do it, you know, to get an assignment in hiding?
Well, I mean, I'm able to receive mail. I mean, I'm not going to go into great detail about how that happens, but it's I've had a relationship with a newspaper in Britain for whom I'd been writing reviews quite regularly, and I would be sent books and read them and you know, send back the reviews. I mean, the mail still works even when you're living in this curious underground life.
Do you feel that your situation has made you any more critical or benevolent a reviewer?
Oh, I hope it hasn't. I hope it hasn't changed my attitude towards that at all. And I think if you're writing reviews, well, the hardest thing to do is to review books that are written by people you know. But even then, you do actually end up having to tell the truth. I mean, I think one of the most difficult things I had to do in that regard was when I was asked to review the last novel by Umberto Eco, Foucault's Pendulum. And Umberto Eco has been fantastically supportive of me and has signed all the relevant petitions and made a considerable amount of noise in Italy and been one of the writers who has been very vocal in my support over these years. And the problem was that I didn't like the novel. So I mean, I suppose there was 5 seconds when I thought, you know, would it be wrong to give this novel a bad review because Eco has been so supportive? And then in the end, you have to tell yourself that you're not being paid to think like that. You're being, you know, what the readers expect is that you will tell the truth about the book that you as you see it. So in the end, I had to trash this novel, which was, I think may have. I can understand that it might have upset Umberto Eco, but there is nothing else one can do if one doesn't like a book.
Well, were you reluctant to take on the assignment in the first place, knowing
no,
that,
I mean,
that this was a possibility?
You see, because I'd liked The Name of the Rose, and so I mean, I obviously hadn't read the book at the time that I was asked to do it. And I thought I would like it, and it turned out that I didn't.
Have you heard from him since?
No, I haven't heard from him since, except indirectly. I think he is probably a little bit miffed.
What are you working on now?
Well, I'm writing a novel, and in fact, we just announced last week that I've just signed a contract for it with Random House in America, Pantheon. So it's nice to be finally back in harness writing a full-scale novel. I mean, oddly, it's a novel I've had in my head for a long time, but it has taken a very long time for me to understand what to do with it. And so now I'm writing it, and I'm afraid the thing that I'm most secretive about in the world is work in progress. So it's very hard for me to tell you much about it.
I can understand that.
Except as I have told one or two journalists, it's got a certain amount of sex and violence in it.
Okay.
I think that's about as much as I'm going to reveal right now. More sex than violence.
More sex than violence?
Yeah.
Okay. How has your health been?
My health's been fine, actually, with the exception of the fact that in a rather strange way, I've contracted asthma, which I've never had in my life, and now I do. I don't have it very badly, but that's been about the only problem I've had, fortunately, with the exception of having to have two wisdom teeth removed in the middle of all this, which required an absurd cloak and dagger operation.
Yes, I remember you telling me that in the last interview we did, and I've been thinking about that a lot since I'm preparing to have mine removed, so I keep thinking, well, it'll be easier for me.
Yes, it probably will be easier for you. Nobody.
I can just walk into the dentist.
Yes, exactly, whereas I had to go in this very curious backdoor method, and people in the hospital thought that some member of the royal family had probably turned up to have an abortion. It wasn't just me and my wisdom teeth, I'm afraid.
So how did you get the asthma? Do you have any idea?
I don't know. I just suddenly contracted it. Apparently there is such a thing as late-onset asthma, and it's what I've got.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose there are theories that it's stress-related, so if that's so, then maybe there is an effect of all this. But apparently it can be brought on by all sorts of things.
I know you had started smoking again in hiding. Did you give it up after you got the asthma?
No, I stopped before I got the asthma. It didn't stop me getting the asthma, though.
Oh, okay.
I did smoke again for about 9 months, but I must say I'm very pleased to reveal that I have returned to being good about that.
Good. Mm. This may seem like an odd question, but I know you're able to talk with friends on the telephone.
Mm.
I know if I were in your position, I'd probably always feel like I had nothing to talk about because there would be no day's events that I could actually tell anyone.
Yeah.
So do you feel like you run out of things to say, aside from talking about things that you've read?
Well, no, I haven't yet, because there's always them to talk about.
Right.
People are always quite happy to talk about themselves.
True.
So I catch up. In fact, I'm probably the kind of gossip centre of London. I probably have more dirt on more people than most of my friends do.
So you can write a Romana Clef novel soon.
One of these days,
right?
Yes. One of these days, well over Harold Brodkey.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Salman Rushdie. His collection of essays, Imaginary Homelands, has been published in paperback by Granta. Satanic Verses is in paperback now, too. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.